And welcome to Pacifica Performance Showcase, Arts and Culture, to enlighten, enliven, and educate. I'm your host, Donna Walker. And I'm very pleased to say that my guest in the first part of the show is the wonderful actress Leslie Manville. You may know her recently as Oscar-nominated for The Phantom Thread. We've actually had her on the show before. She was here with the wonderful Jim Broadbent for the film Another Year by Mike Leigh. So we sat down to chat after having seen her in an extraordinary performance of Long Day's Journey Into Night, the American epic by Eugene O'Neill, which is currently playing at the Wallace Annenberg Theater, beautiful jewel box theater, where she is co-starring with Jeremy Irons, one of the greatest ever. So that will be coming up shortly. And then I will be speaking with filmmaker Will Fraser, whose film, Cowboy and Preacher, The Life and Times of Tri Robinson, is enjoying its premiere at the Dances with Films Film Festival, which is currently running through Sunday. And we'll talk about his film, Cowboy and Preacher, The Life and Times of Tri Robinson. So before we get to that, I do have a couple of announcements. As you just heard, LA Theater Works is presenting Eight. It's an extraordinary all-star cast, of course, honoring Gay Pride Month. It specifically has to do with Proposition 8, which many of you may remember in 2008 stripped away the freedom to marry from gay and lesbian couples. And, of course, this was when two of the nation's most renowned attorneys joined forces to challenge Prop 8. And this is the dramatization by the wonderful Dustin Lance Black, who you know may have won an Oscar for his film about Harvey Milk. So tune into that Sunday night, 10 to 12. And also I wanted to mention, Julio had just covered some of the folks from the Fringe Festival. Sergio Milnashenko of Global Village brought to my attention a young Brazilian director who has a play in the Fringe, Lucas Pass, and I'm looking at my notes here. The play is Seascape with Sharks and Dancer, an American playwright, a Brazilian director, and a Latin cast at the 9th Hollywood Fringe Festival. So you'll want to check that out. It's going to be at the Broadwater Theater Black Box at 6320 Santa Monica Boulevard in L.A. So you can get tickets for that. Check it out at the Hollywood Fringe Festival. And now, without further ado, we're going to go to my pre-recorded interview with the wonderful Leslie Manville, starring in Long Day's Journey Into Night. And welcome to Pacifica Performance Showcase, Arts and Culture, to enlighten, enliven, and educate. I'm your host, Donna Walker, and it is with immense pleasure that I am joined via phone by actress Leslie Manville, who's actually been on this show before. And I think I had to pinch myself then when you were sitting here in studio with Jim Broadbent back for Another Year. So it's such a delight to have you again, Leslie. Welcome.
Oh, well, thank you for having me. Thank you.
Well, and of course, that was a tour de force role. You were Oscar nominated this year for Phantom Thread, another tour de force role. And I have to tell you, I saw Long Day's Journey Into Night. We spoke briefly yesterday.
We did. Yes, we did.
It was stunning. Absolutely stunning.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Yes, it's another huge character who is complex and troubled, as is everybody. All the characters in this play are troubled in their own way. But it's a mighty epic play, and I don't know how many people will know this, but it is autobiographical. It mm-hmm. is about Eugene O'Neill, the writer's family experiences. It's a very devastating play. I think it leaves people quite churned up at the end.
Well, and what's fascinating to me is, as you said, it is kind of an American epic, kind of considered his magnum opus, and he was posthumously received the Pulitzer Prize for it. Mm. It's been done, it's kind of like, an American Hamlet in a way.
Yeah. I agree. It certainly feels like that for me, doing it every night and twice on Saturdays. Yeah, it's a mountain. It is a real mountain to climb each night, but I get an awful lot out of doing it, having said that.
Well, it must be pretty incredible to be co-starring with I don't even have words for Jeremy Irons. I'm such a fan. but that must be a tremendous, climbing that mountain with somebody of his caliber.
Well, I think he feels the same about me.
I think he does.
Yes, listen, we're a good couple of Tyrones, and I think that we work very well, very believably as a couple, as a couple who have, you know, been together for 35 years, and who you can, I think we create the kind of physical attraction that they obviously had and to a degree still have for each other. I think we do that very well with our portrayal of them. But yes, we both have a great deal of experience behind us, and we came to these parts, you know, with some trepidation. It's a complex play, and I think, you know, we've done it in England, we've done it in London, in the West End, but I think we were kind of slightly nervous about bringing a big American play to an American audience, and there's us Brits doing it. They don't seem to be too angry about that.
Well, I mentioned to your director, Richard Eyre. Like Jane Eyre. I do think sometimes that the Brits actually do some stuff better than we Americans. You're well, pretty good with musicals too, so you know.
We're pretty good at theater. It's in our bones.
That's
so
right.
I think that we do that pretty well. Yeah, and it's interesting, nevertheless, bringing this play here to Los Angeles, which is ostensibly a movie city, a kind of theater town. I hope that we're shifting things a bit. The Wallace Annenberg is a beautiful theater. Anybody who hasn't been here, you should come down and see it. It's a beautiful theater, converted 1930s, I believe, post office. Wonderful building, lovely state-of-the-art theater, acoustically marvelous, and, you know, a production that should make people feel quite at home, because it is an American play, and it's a really wonderful, wonderful piece of writing. I mean, I've done a lot of plays over the decades, but I think this one, as a piece of writing, is second to none.
Well, it really is, and if people haven't seen this play, this is the one to see, because I don't think it gets any better than this production, personally. And you, of course, are Oscar nominee, Olivier Award winner, and Jeremy Irons, of course, Academy Award winner, Emmy winner. You've got a superlative cast with you. We should mention your sons. And
yes, Rory Keenan and Matthew Beard play the Tyrone sons, and Jessica Regan plays Kathleen, who is the maid. Yeah, they're wonderful. They're wonderful. Really touching and moving and fine, really fine young actors. Yeah, really excellent.
I also think it's worth mentioning that, you know, it's a very lengthy play. It does fly by, though, because I so appreciate that, you know, there is a good dose of humor in this. The kind of humor that you...
We extract all of the humor that we can from it, because we are certainly whacking people over the head with all sorts of other emotions as the evening goes on. But so I think, there is humor in all situations, be them tragic. And, you know, I was talking to somebody this morning who was only saying that they had been at a funeral, but people were laughing and being humorous about the person who was deceased. And there is humor. Even in the darkest situations, there is humor. And I think it's in the human nature to find that humor. It's a survival instinct. We can be in the most dire situations, but we do try and look for humor as people. We do, because it's sanctuary.
It is. And what struck me, and I shared this with Richard as well, you go this journey with this family, and of course every family has its troubles, and you're digging in deep with these people, and then it's toward the end of the play, and it's an American classic, so I'm not giving anything away to reveal that Mary is she's a morphine addict.
Yeah.
When you come into the room toward the end, almost like specter of Lady Macbeth, almost. Something hit me, and it was very visceral. It wasn't something that I anticipated. But all of a sudden, I thought of it as a reflection of the American psyche and the opioid crisis that we're going through. And I thought, this is really about America and Americans, you know?
Yeah. No, I'm very aware that that is a very prevalent situation here. And even though the play is set in 1912, I mean, Eugene O'Neill wrote it over many years. I believe he started writing it in the 1940s, but it's set in 1912. Don't think for one minute that makes the situation any less or any different or removed in any way. It really doesn't. It is absolutely about here and now. And families, you know, how families are not always what they seem to outsiders. What goes on in those four walls of a family between the family members is varied and at times tragic. Yeah, it does. I'm sure the play does speak very much for the American situation as it stands at the moment, for sure.
Yeah, and I hadn't really seen that or sort of been walloped by that in the past. I've seen the play in a lot of different incarnations, and to my mind, this is definitive. It's as much as theater can be definitive, I guess.
I'm obviously very glad that you feel that. I think that I have heard that from other people, that, you know, our production is certainly a different take on it, but I think we've come at it with trying to be honest and quite candid about the situation and what it is like to live with a morphine addict. And, you know, the research I did, talking to doctors who deal with it every day of their lives, they certainly painted a picture for me of what it's like, and I've done my best to replicate that, which I think is my job, partly my job. It's a very sensitive situation. If I misconstrued it, I would feel responsible in some way. Mm-hmm. So I'm trying to convey it as accurately as I know possible within my understanding of what it's like to be a morphine addict.
And it is, despite all that, it is, there's a lot of love there. There's a lot of, this is a family that cares deeply about each other, even if they aren't always able to express it.
No, that's true. They do feel deeply for each other. And I think that our production certainly highlights the love that the Tyrones had for each other as a couple and that continue to have, which makes the whole situation even more painful. And only serves to show how, you know, you can get things wrong even when you're doing your best to get them right.
You know, anybody out there that has an opportunity to get to the Wallace Annenberg, you run through July 1st. And
yes,
to have the opportunity to see you doing theater live, Jeremy Irons doing theater live, this is a rich and rare opportunity. And I would be remiss if I didn't mention a couple of other things, because I know people may know you from Mum, which
yes,
I'm currently enjoying on PBS here in L.A. It's lovely.
Yes, it's available on PBS and through a fairly new streaming service called BritBox. Yes, Mum is a lovely, lovely series. Yes, really, really lovely.
What a contrast to Mary Tyrone.
I know. Well, that's what I'm after. My remit to myself is to try and play different characters and be chameleon, and that is what keeps me going. I enjoy that hugely. I don't want to just turn out the same characters every time. So yeah, that's good, and they are very different characters. But yeah, Mum is well worth a look. It's a lovely series.
Yes, that character just kind of lets stuff roll off, surrounded by the idiocy, and Mary takes everything in. So it's an interesting.
That's right. Yeah.
I can't begin to tell you how highly I think of this show. There are a few benchmarks for me. I come from theater background, and I remember there are a few productions, all Brits, that stand out in my mind. And one was the Royal Shakespeare Company doing Much Ado About Nothing with Derek Jacobi and Sinead Cusack.
Oh, yes.
And I had the pleasure of not only seeing but interviewing the late, great Alan Rickman, and he did Les Liaisons Dangereuses with Lindsay Duncan, and I'm adding this one to my absolute all-time favorites. I'm adding this to the list.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. That I'm honored that you are. That's very lovely of you.
What's next on your horizon? And then I'll let you go. Do you have...
I'm going back to when the play finishes. I'm going home for 2 days, and then I go to Belfast to shoot a film with Liam Neeson.
Oh, so my goodness.
It's not bad, is it? We're playing husband and wife in a very lovely film about the tragedy of when cancer strikes in a family. So another family saga, but it's just us two this time.
Well, thank you.
Sons.
Thank you so much for taking the time, Leslie. I know you're extremely busy, and it's been a pleasure. You're invited to come back anytime to talk about whatever you happen to be doing.
Thank you, Donna. It's very nice to talk to you too.
Okay, thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Okay. And what a monumental production that is. Again, that's Long Day's Journey Into Night, starring Academy Award winner, Emmy winner, Tony Award winner Jeremy Irons, and Olivier Award winner and Oscar nominee Leslie Manville. See it. And we do have one pair of tickets. These are really hard to get. We do have a pair of tickets, pending availability, of course. But if you're a listener subscriber, haven't won anything in the last couple months, 818-985-5735, 818-985-5735. And now it is my great pleasure to welcome into studio the filmmaker of a very interesting documentary. It just had its premiere at the Dances with Films Film Festival, and it is called Cowboy and Preacher. It is my pleasure to welcome into studio Will Fraser. Welcome.
Thank you. It's very nice to be here.
This is a very intriguing film because, as you know, we're very politically progressive here at KPFK, and the issue of environmentalism is usually sort of owned by the left. And it's unusual, not that people on the right don't care about that, but it's unusual to see the combination of an evangelical preacher, a conservative Republican, who has really been a longtime environmentalist, and that he is the subject of this film, Try Robinson. Tell me about how this project came to be and how you ended up connecting with Try.
Well, the first thing to say, obviously, is that although environmentalism itself might have become political, there's absolutely nothing political about the environment. A mountain or a tree or a lake or the air, that's for everyone. And I think the thing to say first off is that the degradation of the environment, which is happening, is obviously something that in an ideal world everyone would come together to solve. I think thus far a lot of environmental films have been aimed at a liberal progressive audience, which essentially means that they're preaching to the converted. And yet there are people out there who I think, possibly for political reasons rather than the other kind of reasons, are opposing environmental action. And the important thing is obviously to talk to those people. And to do that, I think you have to obviously frame an argument for them, but also you need a messenger, someone to tell them who they would actually respect. And so when I decided I wanted to make this film, I wanted to find that messenger. And I felt that Try Robinson was the absolute perfect person because he's a lifelong environmentalist. And it's worth noting he's now 70 years old, and so he was an environmentalist before the environment was politicized. As he says, in the 1960s, everyone was an environmentalist. Everyone could agree with it. This politicization of the environment is actually something that's relatively recent. But he's also an evangelical pastor with a massively amazing and successful track record of helping people in according to the Christian mandate, obviously to help society as he says in the film, as Jesus asks you to do. The film has various Bible studies in it, and the center of the film is a Bible study from the Gospel of Matthew 24, which is all about helping the least of these. And he in the film shows obviously how the environment ties in with that. In other words, environmentalism can be piggybacked, if you like, on inarguable and already existing Christian priorities.
And he does, first and foremost, deal with it as a moral issue, as stewardship, as taking care of the planet, and that with dominion comes responsibility. And he is very authentic, very genuine, And he kind of came to this as a teacher. He was originally a teacher before he was a preacher.
Yes, he was a biology teacher, in fact. Yeah.
And first of all, let's just say the camera, what the camera captures, the land in Idaho, it takes place in Boise, Idaho, Butte Ranch.
Yep.
Stunning. You couldn't have asked for a more beautiful setting in which to outpicture the gifts that this planet gives us. And he's acutely aware of the precipice that we're standing on in relation to it. And he does walk the walk. Talk about, first of all, I think you did a Q&A at the Dances with Films Film Festival. Was he there for that? And what does he think of the film?
Well, Trey loves the film, which is great. So Trey and I are absolutely on the same page as this. And I certainly see the film as a collaborative effort. I know there are some filmmakers who, I don't know, they just make the film on their own, and who knows, that maybe they diverge with their subject. But Trey and I are walking absolutely in step with each other and have been from start to finish of this process.
And he's passed it down to his son as well, who lives in a little bit more urban setting, but yet has managed to incorporate this into his life.
And his daughter, too. So both of them live on perfectly standard urban plots with houses, normal houses. So maybe the plot would be, say, an eighth of an acre. And they both have created these amazing urban farms. Trey himself has 80 acres, so that's a proper kind of homestead ranch type thing. So he has space for cows and horses and all sorts of animals, duck, geese, chickens, and a big vegetable garden. And he can harvest hay and everything. It's a proper farm, in other words. But you can do all of that stuff in town. But just going back to what you were saying about the western side, the other thing which I think is worth thinking about is now I think things are a little materialistic, and to some degree people derive status from having things and consuming things. And the idea of the person as a consumer, I don't think, is really ultimately compatible with moral development. I think a person has got to be more than just a consumer. And this film is self-consciously a Western. I love Westerns and have always. And as you say, we shot it in Idaho. Trey is, I think, a properly Western character. And America is, if you like, sitting on this fully mythologized environmental hero who actually ultimately is a conservative hero. And I say that because obviously people like to follow people they like. And liberals certainly have no end of environmental figureheads, if you like, to follow. And maybe conservatives need figureheads who they can follow. And the Western hero, if you like, a man's got to do what a man's got to do, but ultimately as someone who lives in balance with nature, they make a masculine virtue out of not taking any more than they need and only taking a small amount, having a much more stoic attitude. And I think that kind of attitude to derive status from not consuming is actually something that could lead to some success as a society in dealing with the environment. And I think the Western milieu is crucial to that.
Well, and he does, as you say, make the point of the idea isn't to live off the land, the idea is to live with the land.
Yes.
And in harmony with that. And also, that, you know, what I was thinking of as I was watching it, because we do see the life of a rancher and a cowboy, and I was thinking of Gene Autry. You know, we have the wonderful Gene Autry Museum here in L.A. And Gene Autry always had the cowboy code. And this is very interesting, because it's things like, you know, he keeps himself clean in thought, speech, action, and personal habits. He must be a good worker. He must help people in distress. He was not advocate or possess racially or religiously intolerant ideas. He must be gentle with children, the elderly, and animals. He must always tell the truth. He must never go back on his word. He must respect women, parents, and the nation's laws. You know, this could really describe Trey Robinson and what he tries to do.
Yes, so what you're saying, I think all of those are totally compatible with a Christian way of life, and obviously many cultural things in our society, even if they're not overtly Christian, are obviously derived from Christian values. So absolutely, but if everyone lived like that, there would be no environmental crisis. It's as simple as that.
It's true, and you know, just on the side note of the Western sensibility, I think part of your attraction to this, ironically, because I was looking in your bio, we were talking about the Sam Peckinpah draw. We've had Paul Sedor on the show, who's got the great book about Sam Peckinpah.
Well, Paul Sedor is a hero of mine. In fact, I'm meeting him in a couple of days, so I'm looking forward to that.
Yes. That's just total coincidence that that came up, but I did see that that whole Western sensibility was a draw to you in the first place. So to kind of take it on in this sort of a modern way with somebody who really does understand that code of his, that guides his own personal morality, is very intriguing, I think.
Absolutely. I mean, I think every English person deep down wants to be a cowboy, and I'm no exception. So it's a wonderful thing to actually be able to make a Western. The Western has allegedly died. Sam Peckinpah was one of the people who killed it off. But I think actually what the Western, why it died was it fell out of step with the values of society. Society became, I think, rather cynical and materialistic. But actually, if we're going to get out of this crisis and are going to come together and are going to see the value in values and perhaps see that relativism and nihilism have perhaps a little bit more in common than we would like, then the Western might actually become more relevant, and then that would be great, and people can start making them. Because, I mean, ultimately, the Western is a frame in which you can hang all sorts of things.
Well, I do want to direct people to your website, because the film at some point will be available for viewing, but we don't know when yet. So if they go to your website, they can see a trailer and get a little glimpse of it and then keep their eyes peeled. I want to thank you so much.
So cowboyandpreacher.com.
Cowboyandpreacher.com. Yeah. Check it out. Thank you so much, Will Fraser. We have to go out. I just want to dedicate today's show to my dad. Father's Day is coming up on Sunday, and unfortunately I lost my father last year, so this show is dedicated to you, Raymond Shuey, wherever you are. I'm going to go out with Leon Russell, My Father's Shoes, and I urge all of you who do still have your dad here with you, do something wonderful for him on Sunday. Thank you so much.
Brad Pitt and George Clooney lead an all-star cast in a timely portrait of an American civil rights struggle.
The witness stand is a lonely place to lie. And when you come into court, you can't do that. And that's what we did. We put Fear and Prejudice on trial.
8 by Dustin Lance Black. Next time on L.A. Theatre Works.
Tune in to L.A. Theatre Works on Sunday evenings from 10 p.m. to 12 a.m. for world-class radio drama right here on KPFK 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kpfk.org.
I'm Andrew Tonkovich, host of Bibliocracy, this week featuring my conversation with a young poet whose debut collection has won a major prize and whose activism on behalf of justice for undocumented Americans has made him both a political and artistic spokesperson. Marcelo Hernandez Castillo's collection, Sensontil, invokes the mockingbird of its title, is composed in short lines, but suggests a surreal vision told in wonderfully idiosyncratic use of idiom, if with very particularly solid objects, and narrated by individual voices. Be introduced to a voice of sadness, sincerity, and vivid engagement, award-winning poet Marcelo Hernandez Castillo, my guest at 5 o'clock on Sunday on Bibliocracy.
Hi, I'm Patti Smith, and you're listening to Fiercely Independent Pacifica Radio, KPFK.